Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Wednesday, September 22nd. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Scott.
And I'm Kendra Nordine Piatto.
In the United States, California has led the way with an ambitious zero emissions goal. By 2035, all new passenger cars and trucks bought in the state will be electric or hydrogen powered. No fossil-fueled autos. Zero. How's that going? Well, progress on this lithium-ion powered road trip is gradual. Just 9% of new car sales in the state are electric vehicles. Nationwide, the figure is about 2.5%. In China, it's 12%. But let's take a look at Norway, which leads the world in this transition. This past month, 72% of all new car sales were electric vehicles. If you throw in hybrid cars, low-emission vehicles, that total jumps to 92% of new car sales. How did Norway get so far down the road to zero emissions? 3 decades of leadership choices across the political spectrum. Yes, we're talking about the polluter pays principle. Norway has high taxes on high-emission cars and low taxes on zero-emission cars. The polluting cars help to finance incentives to buy electric cars. Norway's incentives include no sales taxes on electric vehicles, free access to bus lanes, and a 50% discount for electric cars on toll roads, parking fees, and ferry tickets. Most of the world is just starting the zero emissions journey, but Norway has almost arrived. And that can give the rest of us hope. Now, today's stories. Our first story. For 6 decades, the Peace Corps has been an unusual American hybrid. Part development aid, part cultural exchange, part gentle diplomacy. It's been a program about community and connections. But is it still effective?
Since COVID-19 prompted the evacuation of all its volunteers abroad in March 2020, the Peace Corps has seen America and the world drastically change amid a racial reckoning and a historic pandemic. Now, with plans to return volunteers to the field in early 2022, lingering questions lie before it. Is a program built around sharing American values still relevant? Can Americans even agree on what those values should be? Did the program ever live up to its lofty goals? Perhaps it's not surprising that an organization of idealistic volunteers has plenty of people with passionate thoughts about how to reform, or in some cases, abolish, the program. At the same time, growing America First rhetoric from the political right also threatens what was once a thoroughly bipartisan organization. Irvin Castellano, who served in Fiji, says, "A lot of people take the Peace Corps as an opportunity to party and travel around. And yet, volunteers like Mr. Castellano, focused and humble, represent the program at its best. He used a Peace Corps grant to help his town turn its community center into a cyclone evacuation center. It wasn't much as far as development projects go, not a bold new idea, not a flashy execution, just a small corner of a tiny island thousands of miles from Mr. Castellano's New Jersey hometown, made a little better by his presence." This story was reported by Ryan Lenora Brown in Johannesburg and Nick Roll in Edison, New Jersey, for The Monitor.
Relationships are built on trust and communication. Our London columnist explores the rift between France and the U.S. and whether the breach may lead to less cooperation on China.
The row that has broken out about Australia's decision to scrap a deal to buy French submarines and switch to U.S.-made vessels, a move that Paris calls a stab in the back, is about more than French amour propre. It risks opening even deeper fissures in the transatlantic alliance, the bedrock of U.S. foreign policy for more than seven decades. The way Australia, the United States, and Britain had negotiated in secret for months to create a new security alliance dubbed AUKUS, the way neither European Union nor NATO allies were forewarned of the announcement, all that smacked of the way they had been left out of the loop on last month's U.S. withdrawal from Kabul, Afghanistan. That has left some in Europe wondering whether they can rely on Washington anymore, and it has reinforced arguments that the Europeans should take a more independent foreign policy tack on issues such as China rather than let America take the lead. As President Joe Biden seeks to rally allies into a democratic front against autocratic leaders such as China's Xi Jinping, Europe's overall aim, said EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell last week, is cooperation, not confrontation. This column was written by Ned Temko in London for The Monitor.
One takeaway from recent major U.S. storms, a reporter finds, is the need for greater power grid resilience. He explores how that might happen.
When Hurricane Ida knocked out power for about 1 million Louisiana customers amid sweltering heat and humidity, it was part of a larger pattern. Extreme weather events, which scientists say are being amplified by climate change, have threatened communities and their power grids in other parts of the United States. The result is an awakening by citizens and policymakers alike that power grids need attention, not just repair, but perhaps reimagining to withstand future extremes. Investments can help harden the grid by reducing potential points of critical failure, putting lines underground where feasible, and adding redundancy. But all this is costly, and on top of investments in resilience, by some estimates, America needs to spend $370 billion or more per decade in new capacity for power distribution, as the nation relies on more renewable power for things like automotive transport. Our energy system is fragile, says Michael Weber, a professor of energy resources at the University of Texas. In Texas, it costs $5 billion to $20 billion to winterize the energy system. But it promises to avoid multiples of that amount in damage from storms like the one that hit the state early this year. The cost of inaction, he says, is pretty expensive. The story was reported by Xander Peters in New Orleans for The Monitor.
While victorious in the fight for Indigenous recognition and rights in Canada, a Newfoundland band is now wrestling with questions of inclusion and identity.
Calvin White spent his adulthood fighting for recognition of his people, the Mi'kmaq community of Newfoundland. Beginning in the 1970s, he traveled across the province organizing residents into what would later become the Federation of Newfoundland Indians. And he challenged legislation before the courts that led to the creation of the Halu First Nation in 2011. This week marks its 10th anniversary. But Mr. White says the struggle for justice is more pressing than ever. While recognition was a crowning achievement, the creation of the nation has also been mired in controversy over membership, surfacing divisive debates about identity that have split families. And looking back at the long road to recognition, Mr. White is concerned the movement has veered from its original struggle for inclusion and equity. "I'm more engaged now in the fight than I was in the 70s," he says. After 10 years, I've realized that the fight has gotten bigger. It's absolutely necessary to reflect back on where we are and try to correct some of the injustices and the wrongs that we're now faced with, not in our struggle with the federal government, but our own struggle in Halu. This story was reported by Sarah Miller-Yana in Flat Bay, Newfoundland, for The Monitor.
We return to the Peace Corps with a personal essay from a former volunteer who suggests that learning how to bridge cultural divides with a sense of humility may be exactly what the world needs today.
It wasn't until I returned home from the Peace Corps that I noticed the Senegalese restaurant down the street. I instantly knew this was somewhere where I could speak Wolof, to the confused delight of the kitchen staff, writes Monitor correspondent Nick Roll. I joined the Peace Corps in 2018 for the opportunities to experience West Africa, to improve my foreign language skills, and to do some meaningful work along the way. I never thought lessons learned there would be applicable back home. But here I was, in my hometown of Cincinnati, speaking Wolof with a set of neighbors I had never known I had before. The Peace Corps always has had two missions: to build literal bridges through volunteer work and to build more figurative cultural bridges. One can easily log the number of wells built or mothers trained in nutrition class. It's harder to measure the impact of cultural exchange carried out, cross-border friendships made possible, or worldviews expanded. In many ways, the figurative bridges that the Peace Corps built are exactly what today's divided yet shrinking world needs a heavy dose of. The challenge for the program will be making sure its ideals are being lived out in the field and not just on paper in Washington. This first-person essay was written by Nick Roll in Dakar, Senegal, for The Monitor.
Now, commentary from The Monitor's editorial board on community gardens. When the American Community Gardening Association holds its annual conference this week, one goal is to share stories of how gardens made a difference during the pandemic. For sure, topics like composting and urban food deserts will be discussed. But with a surge in renting garden plots this year, organizers want to focus on how community gardens have been a source of resiliency, or a reaping of stronger ties between neighbors during a tough time. Working garden plots together has been a way for people to break the pandemic's isolation, as well as ensure a supply of food. Shared gardens are a mirror on what a community stands for. They must operate on golden rule economics, challenging the theory that humans will secretly exploit a shared resource, or what is called the tragedy of the commons. Today's community gardens, born out of the victory gardens of last century's world wars, keep offering fresh purposes beyond just providing fresh and inexpensive food. In challenging times, like a pandemic, they offer a harvest of insights on what holds a community together. That's our news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thanks for joining us. Come back tomorrow. We're working on a story about mudlarking. That's digging along the banks of the River Thames for lost artifacts and finding respite from the city. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how to experience stability, peace of mind, and healing, even when we're faced with difficult situations. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Finally, a grace note of gratitude to our staff, including today's audio production team, Tim Malone, Tori Silver, and Tara Adikari.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.